This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Writer John Lee Anderson has covered armed conflict in some of the most remote regions of the world. He was among the first Western journalists in Afghanistan after the September 11th attacks, and he's written about guerrilla leaders in Burma and the Western Sahara. For the past 2 years, Anderson's dispatches from Iraq have given readers of The New Yorker magazine compelling pictures of war and its aftermath, from looters making off with a fire truck to intimate conversations with the man known as Saddam Hussein's doctor. Anderson was in Iraq during the buildup to war and remained there throughout the invasion. He's returned several times to cover the post-war reconstruction and insurgency. His new book, The Fall of Baghdad, looks at the Iraq experience in part through the eyes of Iraqis he came to know. I spoke with John Lee Anderson yesterday and asked what his driver, a man named Sabah, experienced in the early stages of the war.
Sabah, like virtually every Iraqi I knew, was directly affected in just those 3 weeks of bombardment of Baghdad. Almost everyone I knew had a member of the family killed. One of Sabah's daughters lost a child, had an involuntary abortion during a particularly intense bombardment of Baghdad one night. She survived but lost the child. One of Sabah's nephews was found dead by the roadside, having apparently bled to death for 2 days. No one helped him in those final days when very few people ventured out on the street and the bombing was intense. By the end of the war, Sabah had, as I say, lost a nephew, an unborn grandson, his daughter had lost the child, and in the aftermath of the city, as the chaos began to gather in Iraq, his life closed down considerably. His son, Allah, who was 11, was kidnapped for several days until he paid a ransom, sold a car to pay the ransom. That was late last year. And like most Iraqis, like most people in Baghdad, life had become extremely insecure, and the hopes he had of a new life, a beginning, were almost completely crushed.
Now, this man, Sabah, was someone who was cooperative with a Westerner before the war, who hated the Saddam Hussein regime, and had you know, some real tragedy and difficulty as a result of the war and its chaotic aftermath. How does he now regard the American invasion and occupation?
Well, Sabah's feelings were all over the place, even during the initial war. I'm speaking of the one that lasted a short time and led to the downfall of Saddam. He swung between a desire to see Saddam go quickly, and feelings of anguish and anger over the casualties being caused by the American bombings. So by the end of the war, I'm speaking of April, May 2003, he was, like most Iraqis, just awash in conflicting emotions, but hoping for things to be set right. And a huge sense of disillusionment entered very soon when the looting of the city began and continued and led on into the insurgency. Sabah really, in a sense, is a kind of casualty of the post-war. He was a driver. That's what he did. He was my man Friday. We became very close during the war. But within 2 months of the fall of Baghdad, he was showing himself incapable of dealing with the rapid changes, the tremendous insecurity that came with the fall of Baghdad and the new era of guerrilla violence and the targeting of Westerners in particular. And he was no longer capable of protecting me. And in one incident in the summer of 2003, he got us caught in a firefight in an urban street in Baghdad. And after that, I realized I had to switch people. I had to have someone who was quick-witted and who smelt danger. Sabah was a man of the Ancien regime. He understood the dangers, the abstract dangers of the Saddam tyranny, but not of the new era. And thereafter, I began moving around with someone else.
It struck me that in a lot of your conversations with educated Iraqis, many of them before the war said the Americans should not think that they're going to be able to occupy this country. We have a history of driving away foreigners. And yet afterward, when the chaos began to spread, many of them said to you, why don't the Americans seize control and establish order? For people like Sabah and many others who found their lives almost unlivable because of the lawlessness in the land, did they want the Americans to go away and leave Iraqis to their own devices, or did they want the Americans to crack down and punish the lawbreakers?
They wanted both things. On the one hand, I think all Iraqis were understandably humiliated by the specter of foreign occupation. They went from being oppressed by Saddam and living cravenly under his rule, informing on one another, never speaking their mind, living in terror that another wave of bloodletting would occur, as Saddam had unleashed so many times over the years, watching their step. But essentially, most of them had learned to live. He was the beast they knew. Suddenly, they were faced with roadblocks manned by 18 and 19-year-old American boys with guns who didn't speak their language, didn't know their city, and behaved in a kind of rainbow coalition of ways. You never knew what you were going to get. Some would be out of their heads, cursing and screaming and sometimes shooting people at the roadblocks, and other times you'd get the quintessential polite young American soldier boy. And it was clear very early that they didn't know the terrain they were standing on, which in turn, I think, gave heart to the guerrillas, the insurgents, who very quickly began moving against them as they saw that the Americans were only skeetering on the very surface of their society and didn't know what lay beneath.
One of the people that you talked to, I guess Dr. Waleed, gave you an interesting insight into how American soldiers' activities in Fallujah probably inflamed anti-American sentiments without even meaning to by patrolling on rooftops, right?
That's right.
What was the mistake they made?
Well, it was in fact what led up to the initial hostile demonstration, whereupon Americans fired and killed Iraqis, which in turn set off Fallujah, if you will, a year ago last April. They were, you know, Iraqi cities are flat-roofed, and the Americans had taken over a primary school in the city. They had met no hostile resistance in the city at all. There had been no fighting there. And they moved out to Fallujah from Baghdad a couple of weeks after the fall of the city, merely to establish a presence there. They took over a school and then set, you know, snipers, ambush positions on the rooftops. The problem is that this gave them vantage points into neighboring courtyards of people's homes. And to this very traditional conservative society where women are generally kept in the house, in fact, their only real area of freedom, unrobed, where their faces are showing, are in the family courtyards. And so the men of the area believed that the Americans were spying on their women, which was a great dishonor to them, and very quickly inflamed the local sentiments, whereupon they sent a demonstration against they sent a protest march against the soldiers. The Americans didn't react well. They fired into the crowd and killed 17.
I'm interested in how educated Iraqis that you dealt with, many who had government jobs, fared in the post-war environment. Did you meet any of the government ministers who were your minders or spin artists after the fall of Hussein? I'm thinking in particular of Uday. I had trouble with the name, Attai, who was so strident in defending the government's position, even as American tanks were moving into Baghdad. Did you see any of these folks after the fall?
I did. I looked up a number of them. In fact, I went to see Uday Altaye, who I began to call Goebbels during the weeks we were locked into the Palestine Hotel with him during the bombing of Baghdad. He was the most odious and strident of martinets for the regime and began wearing a pistol and a uniform, and he was given to intoning stentoriously to the press and moralizing about the need to tell the truth and so on. And but stayed at his post until tanks were on the other side of the river from the Palestine Hotel, and only then did he disappear. 2 months later, I climbed the stairs of his apartment block and found him sitting on the 10th floor, no electricity, no elevator working, urine and garbage all over the stairs of this apartment building near the ministry he had once run, the information ministry now bombed out, and found him in his dishdasha robe with his wife and child, and acridly defending his position, trying to reaffirm that he had always been a friend of the Western press, insisting that he had been secretly opposed to Saddam Hussein, and wanting me to believe it was so. Now, after all of the events that had occurred, and I let him speak for, it must have been more than an hour in this sort of monologue of his, rewriting history, as it were.
You know, I'm interested in if his tone had changed. Was he the arrogant, strident defender he was, or was he friendly and charming and ingratiating himself with you?
Well, he was always a little bit schizophrenic. He could be friendly and charming one moment and terrifying the next, and arrogant. And he was warm and friendly, but as he began speaking, the old soapbox came out, and he was trying to insist that I knew him to be a man of compassion and humanity and so forth. In particular, he was very angry that the Americans intended to abolish his ministry. And this was before the insurgency had started, and he was referring to the Americans who'd arrived as short-sighted and stupid and so forth. And finally I said to him, you know, the Americans might be forgiven for not wanting you back at work. After all, you were arguably one of the men who were the public face of the regime. And in a country where mass graves are now being discovered, it's understandable if some people might associate you with that. I said it quite diplomatically. And he looked at me and he said, I was only doing my duty. I was never part of that. And it was interesting because what he said was what all of them said afterwards. There was an absolute refusal to accept any responsibility for anything or apologize for anything. And I think, in a way, it's the twin disaster of Iraq. On the one hand, the incredible lack of ability to engage with Iraqi society, and the short-sightedness, on the one hand, of the American planners of the post-war, and on the other hand, a society that is so traumatized and twisted, really, that not one Iraqi to date has come forth in public and said they are sorry for anything that's ever happened there in the last 35 years. And, you know, the twain do not meet.
You know, I'm interested in people who weren't directly implicated in, you know, the brutality and crimes of the regime, but educated Iraqis who have skills which will be useful in building a new society, which, as I read your account, don't seem invested in it and seem alienated from it. I'm thinking of Dr. Walid, who was a physician who looks as if he may leave the country. What is it about the situation that is turning people like that, who have education and skills, away from a society that really needs them?
Fear. Dr. Walid is a prominent doctor at a clinic in Iraq, where just last week one of the surgeons was assassinated. There have been the professional class of Baghdad have been targeted by assailants since the Americans arrived, and as far as I'm aware, none of these crimes have been investigated or followed up. There's never been an arrest for the murder of, I think it's now over 24 doctors. The same is true in the universities, where prominent teachers and lecturers have been killed. To all intents and purposes, the intelligentsia of Iraq have been are being assassinated and are being driven out. Many tens of thousands have left. They're living in neighboring countries where their families and they can be safe, in Jordan, in the United Arab Emirates, in Syria, in other countries. Dr. Walid was still there as of midsummer. He was hanging on, but he was extremely worried about the situation, as he had been for the preceding months, and was exploring the possibility of leaving. There is, for a doctor, they simply don't have the funds to protect themselves. They don't have the money that Westerners do to hire security contractors with armored cars and automatic weapons at $1,000 a day, in order to do their jobs. It's fear. Whoever is behind the campaign of targeting Iraq's intelligentsia is doing it extremely well, and one suspects that it has a motive, and that is to break Iraqi society down to a common denominator that is more or less putty in the hands of the political movements trying to shape it.
What's going on there? I mean, is this the various militias who seek to control the country? I mean, don't they realize that they're going to govern, they're going to need, you know, people with education to run things?
They do. I spoke with a friend the other day, that an Iraqi who has a theory that it is in fact the Islamist extremists who are trying to kill the educated elite, who after all were mostly educated in the West and secular, whether Shia or Sunni. And so there is a logic behind this, and we've seen it in other totalitarian regimes that have seized power, in whether right or left, from Pol Pot's Kampuchea to Mengistu's Ethiopia and so on, where the intellectuals and the professional class are amongst the first to go onto the heap, the carcass heap, because then you have a population that you can mold at your will. It's a frightening theory, but there does seem to be something in it.
Maybe something like a Taliban regime in Iraq.
To all intents and purposes, I mean, when one would have to characterize the head chopping, bomb exploding jihadi extremists who have now made such a name for themselves in Iraq, one would have to equate them with something like the Taliban, only more sophisticated. It's quite frightening.
To what extent are foreigners who've come into Iraq responsible for this?
There were not foreigners, many jihadis in Iraq when the Americans arrived. They arrived during the war. I remember they stayed in our hotel, and I watched them leave the hotel within 2 hours, 2 hours before the Americans actually arrived in the city. I watched about 60 young men from many countries who had come to participate in suicide operations against the Americans during the war just fade off into the city. And I'm sure many of them became part of the cells that soon began fighting and continue the American presence. The Americans have never really guarded Iraq's borders, thereby making it manna from heaven for any jihadi and Islamist who wants to come and kill Americans.
You're a journalist, not a policymaker, but the view you present is so lacking in hope. Should the Americans simply leave?
The Americans cannot leave. The Americans now have, quite apart from geostrategic interests, which dictate that America remain where it has invaded and make good of it, because the consequences now are of a vastly heightened Islamist extremist phenomena occurring as a result of Iraq. If America were to leave, it would be even further chaos. I don't pretend to have any solutions to the current situation, but America must make good. Less than 10% of the money earmarked for reconstruction in Iraq has actually been spent. By and large, most of it has been spent on security. There's very little the average Iraqi can point to that is positive about the American presence. And the Americans must find a way to make their presence in Iraq part of an international effort which is all about rebuilding Iraq and making life better for its people. It must prevail, or it will be the greatest failure in generations of foreign policy.
Well, John Lee Anderson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Writer John Lee Anderson. His new book is The Fall of Baghdad. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.